Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Today, we interview Dr. Helen Caldicott about the ongoing dangers of the Fukushima disaster. The second half of the show, we'll talk with Jim Riccio, a lawyer who has worked for Greenpeace since 2001 as its nuclear policy analyst.
Joining us today is Dr. Helen Caldicott, a prominent pediatrician who left her medical practice in 1980 after the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. To publicize the dangers of nuclear power, nuclear weapons on Earth and in space, she's written 8 books, featured in many films, has been a contributor to really challenging the idea of nuclear power in the world. Dr. Helen Caldicott, welcome.
Thank you.
We're coming up on the 3rd anniversary of the disaster in Fukushima, and of course we're learning more and more about the ongoing disaster and effects there. Could you tell us what's going on there right now that you think is one of the most important things that we should be paying attention to?
There are 3 important issues facing the world: the imminent, ever-present threat of nuclear war, and the missile officers are now being fired because they're taking drugs and they're irresponsible. So life, our life and our future is in their hands, number one. Number two, global warming, which is upon us. And in Australia, we're experiencing huge temperatures at the moment. And no one seems to give a damn. Everyone burns coal, exports coal, as if there's no tomorrow. And there won't be, because we're creating the global gas oven. Number three, nuclear power in Fukushima. What is happening at Fukushima is there have been 3 meltdowns, which is unheard of in history, and those molten cores, each of 100 tons of extremely hot, thermally hot, radioactively hot uranium, melted their way through 6 inches of steel onto the containment vessel floor, which is all cracked and floored, or into the earth. Now, the reactors were built in front of a mountain range, and they were built on an ancient riverbed. So water flows continually down from the mountains underneath the reactors, which was all fine before the earthquake and the reactors were destroyed. And the water, huge amounts every day, flows down, mixes with the molten cores and flows out into the Pacific. So every day since the accident, which is nearly 3 years ago, as you said, about 300 to 400 tons of severely radioactive water has been flowing into the Pacific. The problem is that there's no end in sight. No one can get near the molten cores. They're so radioactive. People can't even get into the buildings in which they're located, buildings 1, 2, and 3. They also are pouring about 400 tons of water every day into the 3 molten cores to keep them cool so they don't melt any further or start fissioning again to produce another huge release of radiation. And that water is being pumped out, because it's extremely radioactive, into huge tanks that have been built around the reactors. It's called a tank farm, over 1,000, about 3 stories high each one, built with modicum of safety, held together by plastic adhesions and corroding bolts. Many of these tanks are leaking, and also they're producing bremsstrahlung radiation, which is like X-rays, really quite high levels, which is irradiating the workers who walk around checking the tanks for leaks. Now, there are over 1,000. If there's another earthquake greater than 7, those tanks will collapse, and huge amounts more of radioactive water are going to be flowing to the Pacific Ocean. Building 4 is very tenuous. It was really damaged by the earthquake. And in Building 4, on the roof 100 feet above the ground, is what's called a cooling pool containing at least 2 cores or 240 tons of extremely radioactive fuel rods. And if Building 4 collapses with an earthquake greater than 7, down comes the building, down comes the cooling pool, out flows the water, and the zirconium cladding of the fuel rods will react with air, catch fire, burn, and it could release 10 times more cesium than was released at Chernobyl, or the equivalent of 14,000 Hiroshima bombs. Should that happen, the government in Japan is seriously talking about evacuating Tokyo, in which there are 35 million people, which is a physical impossibility. David Suzuki, a wonderful environmentalist in Japan, says that means bye-bye Japan, but it also will be extremely serious for the public health of the people of the Northern Hemisphere because the air masses at the equator do not mix, so the radiation in the atmosphere will only affect the Northern Hemisphere, and of course it will affect America and just very quickly move around the globe to Europe and the like, causing large amounts of fallout. And the water, of course, continues to flow, and the main plume of radiation will be hitting the western shores of America in a couple of months.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is measuring the radiation levels on the West Coast? RadNet, EPA? I mean, we live on the West Coast.
EPA is not.
Correct. Well, that's what we understand.
Yeah, well, there are some private people doing measurements, and people have bought Geiger counters, some of which are reliable and some are not. People are, you know, posting measurements on the internet, but the EPA has taken no responsibility whatsoever, nor the FDA, because the fish are becoming radioactive because they concentrate the radioactive elements in their flesh. And the food chain in the sea will become quite contaminated. Of course, the ocean, the Pacific, is a huge body of water. It will dilute the elements, but the solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation because at each step of the food chain, algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, us, the elements are concentrated by orders of magnitude at each step, and we stand at the apex of the food chain. So, and you can't taste radiation in the fish. You can't smell it. And it takes from 5 to 80 years to develop a cancer once you've eaten radioactive material. So it's a latent cryptogenic silent incubation time, and no cancer declares its origin. The problem with this is I can see, and most other scientists cannot see an end in sight. So we're in a very invidious, dangerous situation in terms of global public health.
We're talking with Dr. Helen Caldicott. Helen, are we looking at the possibility of extinction in the Northern Hemisphere?
No, not from this.
Not from this.
Certainly from global warming, and it's happening far faster than anyone predicted, and certainly from the threat of nuclear war, which could happen tonight, and everyone seems to have forgotten that, like lemmings walking towards the cliff of a nuclear annihilation. A meltdown at a reactor will not produce extinction at all. But what it will do, and also the huge amounts of radioactive waste accumulating at reactors all around the world, but particularly in America, that waste will leak inevitably over time, over generations, incorporated into food and human bodies, and there will be epidemics of cancer, leukemia, genetic disease, and congenital malformations for the rest of time. And as a biologist and pediatrician, the thing that worries me the most, I think, is that the radiation will incur huge numbers of genetic abnormalities and destroy the positive process of evolution, which took place because of radiation, but it takes, you know, a millennia for advantageous mutations to occur. Most mutations that develop are deleterious. In other words, they cause diseases like cystic fibrosis, diabetes, phenylketonuria, dwarfism. There are over 6,000 such diseases now described, and they will increase in frequency. So we're destroying the very basis building blocks of life, not just in humans, but all species.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, all of the things that we're hearing from you now, of course, at Project Censored, we were covering Fukushima underreported stories just after the event. We've had chapters in our book about it by Brian Covert, who's in Japan, that talked about a history of how Japan basically had nuclear power foisted on them by the U.S., General Electric, and so on. But one thing that we're noticing here, in addition to the many things that you're now saying, we don't hear this from a lot of other places, a lot of other sources. There's a media blackout. Japan has recently passed laws essentially criminalizing the whistleblowing that we need to find these things out. TEPCO has been lying from the beginning. Isn't it so that that's been one of the real problems here, is that it's hard for people to find information?
Yes, there's a massive cover-up. not only in Japan, where doctors have even been told not to tell their patients that their symptoms are, or could be related to radiation exposure, which is criminal, but also in America, because you're run by the nuclear priesthood. The weapons makers, who seem to be promised another $1 trillion to the year to 2030 to replace all nuclear weapons and all delivery systems, for God's sake, it's absolutely criminally insane. And they have a huge influence in Congress, but they're allied with the nuclear power industry. And because it's a complex science, politicians mostly are scientifically illiterate, and they literally lay down in front of this nuclear priesthood when they appear in Congress, and they get whatever they want, these nuclear priests. And Obama's pro-nuclear. He received a huge amount of money from Exelon, who has the greatest number of nuclear power plants in America, mostly surrounding Chicago. So he's bought and sold. And the media, well, look, you've got Fox, and you can't trust Fox in any way, shape or form. And the New York Times has written a few serious articles, but not enough. And the television hasn't picked it up, except Russia Today and Al Jazeera, and Amy Goodman's just been there doing a wonderful report. But that's not enough, and people should be talking about this, thinking about it. What they must do is close down all the reactors in America because of this accident.
How long does this take? It does take some pretending in America to think that we're just going to be able to do that. But with efforts, you know, there can be headways made, and certainly looking at Fukushima is certainly a big lesson. It's a learning opportunity, a teachable moment, we might say. How long would it take for us to decommission plants? How long could this take? In other words, those of us that are paying attention, those of us that are listening to people like yourself, we know that this is a very big enormous problem, in fact, bigger than Chernobyl. How long would it take us to decommission plants?
If the people rose up, as we did in the 80s, to end the Cold War, and, you know, when I first arrived in America, most people said to me in 1978, look, it's better to be dead than red. And I thought, this is a form of mass psychosis. So I organized 23,000 physicians in positions for social responsibility to teach people what nuclear war really means to them, that they'll be vaporized and cut by shards of flying glass and turned into missiles themselves and huge firestorms. And over 5 years then, 80% of Americans became opposed to nuclear war, and that led essentially to the end of the Cold War. Mind you, the weapons stayed in place because Clinton had no spine to do anything about it. But certainly, if you get the assent of the media to educate people, then people respond enormously. And it was Jefferson who said an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. That's number one. People must be educated. Number two, it's very easy. You shut the nuclear reactors down, just drop the control rods down, which stops the fissioning reaction. Then they have to remain in situ for up to 30 or years to cool down, to remove the rods and to actually decommission the reactors themselves, because they're so radioactive, they'll have to be cut apart by remote control and robots. And then all the reactor parts themselves are radioactive and will have to be sent to radioactive waste dumps. And the spent fuel, of which there are about 70,000 tons of civilian spent fuel in America now, no one knows what to do with it. Any container you put it in will leak and rust within 100 years and contaminate the biosphere. So we really are, you know, we're slow stepping towards, you know, genetic extinction in a certain sense, but we'll all be dead. It's going to take many, many, many generations for this to occur. Although there's a wonderful scientist now called Tim Mousseau, an evolutionary biologist, who is risking his own life and life of his co-workers by going to the exclusion zones of Chernobyl and Fukushima and studying the birds and the wildlife. The birds have smaller than normal brains. Many of the male birds are sterile. They have tumors, they have genetic malformations, and the same with the insects and the plants are becoming deformed. Now, what happens to wildlife happens to us, because we always experiment with drugs in animals before we use them in medicine. So you extrapolate from what Tim is finding, and he really deserves a Nobel Prize for the work he's doing, to humans. And because, you see, birds reproduce very fast over a year, so you get many generations you can follow, whereas we take a long time to reproduce. It might take 20 generations for abnormal mutations for cystic fibrosis, diabetes and the like to manifest themselves. So what to do with the waste? No one knows, no one does know. And there's a thing called the waste confidence bill, if you please, where the nuclear industry has confidence that one day they'll work out what to do with nuclear waste. And they've been saying to me for 40 years, don't worry, we'll find a solution to the storage of radioactive waste. And I said, look, that's like me saying to a patient, you've got pancreatic carcinoma, you'll probably die in 6 months, but don't worry, I'm an excellent scientist, and in 20 years I might find the cure.
Helen, this sounds incredibly serious. Is there anything that can be done about Fukushima, the meltdown there? Can we throw $1 trillion at it and try to contain it? I mean, what needs to be done?
First of all, TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which now has been nationalized because they've run out of money and the federal government is paying for it, but the Japanese government really is TEPCO and vice versa. They're only operators. They just know how to press switches and the like. They're not nuclear engineers. What should happen is a massive outcry by the international community and the United Nations to demand that well-qualified companies like Bechtel, who I dislike because they build reactors, but they're very adept at what they do, the best nuclear engineers in the world from France and Britain and the like, move into Japan and sit down around a round table and work out what on earth they can do. Some people have suggested building a wall of zeolite near the mountains. Zeolite is a clay which absorbs cesium. Don't forget there are several hundred isotopes in the core. Some have decayed, but many are still there. Not just cesium. I mean, about 100 that are circulating in this water and go to various organs in the body. If eaten, the zeolite wall would therefore stop the contaminated water polluting the water coming from the mountains, and the water from the mountains could be diverted by pipes and then taken into the Pacific. So that would stop the sort of ongoing pollution of the Pacific, except that they're going to have to keep cooling those cores and they're running out of room to put the tanks, and so they're going to eventually have to pour that water into the Pacific. That's the only sort of solution. Some people say that they can cut the reactor buildings down by half and then pour concrete into the whole thing, the whole mess, like they did at Chernobyl. But that won't remove the radioactive cores, and they're going to continue to be radioactive for thousands and thousands of years. So I'm only a physician, although I know a lot about nuclear power, having studied it intensely. I talk a lot to Arnie Gunderson, who is a nuclear engineer who explains things beautifully. That's the solution he came up with, the zeolite wall. The Japanese are talking about building a frozen wall around the whole complex. In other words, you put electrodes or sort of refrigeration tubes deep into the soil, very close together, and freeze the soil. But you see, if there's an electricity breakdown, the soil will melt. And, you know, how much energy would it require to run that for over 100 years? It's ridiculous. So I think that the best thing to do when you've got a complicated case in medicine, you bring in the neurologist and the cardiologist and the renal specialist and the like, sit down and work out what on earth you're going to do with this patient with multiple organ failure. And I think that's what's required by the international community. And there has to be a huge public outcry for that to happen, I think. And also, you know, if it's Bechtel, I'll need to be paid. they won't do it for free, I'm sure, for the good of mankind.
Well, Dr. Helen Caldicott, the raising of awareness about the seriousness of what's happening at Fukushima, and of course with nuclear power and weapons more broadly. Recently, the U.S. Navy, the USS Ronald Reagan, there have been over 70 cases of people. The Reagan was the vessel that went over in 2011 and went to help after the earthquake and the disaster there. There are serious health risks and problems now being measured among these sailors. And, of course, living in America under the so-called War on Terror and the support the troop bumper sticker mantras, do you think that this might rise to the level of getting people paying more attention?
I don't know. I held a conference last year in March, second anniversary of Fukushima, at the New York Academy of Medicine called the Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima with just some of the best scientists in the world, and that's going to be turned into a book called Crisis Without End, which will be published in July. But we had two of the sailors there who testified, and the doctors questioned them. That ship was diverted to within a few miles of Fukushima after the accident. And the ship was bathed, literally bathed in radiation. The sailors thought, you know, oh, look at this, it's radioactive snow. And they played in it and frolicked in it. Many developed symptoms of acute radiation illness, bleeding and rashes and the like. And the ship sort of circled within that perimeter for months. The sailors also flew in helicopters to help the victims of Fukushima, and they were heavily exposed, people who cleaned the helicopters. Finally, the ship was taken to port, I think in Portland or in Seattle, and decontaminated for over a year. Now, the Navy, the senior officers were given neutral potassium iodide tablets to block the uptake of radioactive iodine into their thyroids. That only protects the thyroid, and only 70% protection. Doesn't protect any other organs from any of the other isotopes. But the lower class of people on the ship, they weren't given any iodine at all. And they had to sign a document when they left the Navy to say they would not hold the Navy responsible, which is absolutely criminal. They were not given full-body medical examinations, and to this day, some of them have not been properly examined. They have to cover their own medical expenses now, and it is documented, although I haven't seen the actual data, that some have developed cancers and leukemia. I did hear from the female officer that she had severe abnormalities with the periods and bled ferociously, and her fellow seaman, he developed lumps around his body and the like, but wasn't properly examined by a physician. So they're in sort of between a rock and a hard place, and they're not getting decent medical care. They're having to pay for it themselves. And it seems like they are developing some malignancies now. I haven't seen the actual data yet, and I can't really comment in depth unless I do see the medical tests and examinations, if they exist. But will it arouse the American people? Only if it gets massive publicity, number one. And number two, it was fascinating. The media were really fairly disinterested in the extraordinary scientific papers being presented at that conference, but they were pretty turned on by the fact that some Americans were exposed to radiation. So it seemed like they didn't care too much about the Japanese, but, you know, when their own people got irradiated, that might be different. So I don't know.
Well, Dr. Helen Caldicott, if any measure is sort of the way that the first responders after 9/11 were treated, you know, that doesn't bode well. Those people still struggling, many dying. We hope to raise more awareness around these issues, and that's certainly why we're doing this program with you today. Peter?
Amy Goodman, on her show when she was in Japan, talked about 350,000 refugees now in Japan, many of whom had been exposed to radiation as well. We don't hear a whole lot about that. Does corporate media just want to ignore this, Dr. Helen Caldicott?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of the people in the media now are young, too, and having grown up with the consciousness of what nuclear power means, they were probably babies or not born when Chernobyl happened in Three Mile Island. They haven't been taught in school mostly about what radiation means and how it causes cancer and the whole nuclear fuel cycle from beginning to end. And I think that the bosses, like Roger Ailes, I think he's a wicked character. I can't really answer because I'm not part of the corporate media, but the corporate media is certainly ignoring global warming, and we're digging up coal like there's no tomorrow and burning it like there's no tomorrow. And really, I'd have to tell you that Australia is experiencing the most ghastly heat at the moment. People are dying with cardiac arrests, etc., because it's so hot, hotter than it's ever, ever been during record keeping. So I think the corporate media, controlled by the corporations, which control the Congress, and many people in the Congress are corporate prostitutes because they take money from the corporations to get re-elected, and they don't really represent the people at all, except Bernie Sanders does. Some have moral consciences, but mostly they parrot the corporate line, and the corporate line is bottom and top line is the dollar. And so it seems like they're intent on destroying the earth to make more money. And I've talked to these people, you know, and I say, well, I talked to a young man who is making cruise missiles, and I said, well, what about your children? He has young children. He said, I'm making money. And I said, yeah, but what about your children's future? And he looked at me with eyes like dead stones and said, I'm making money. Now, when these people are on their deathbeds or their children are dying, they fall into my arms weeping, literally, and confess all the wicked things they've done in their life, but it's too late. In other words, when they're at the coalface of life and death, they know what they've done, meaning they've known all their lives what they're doing. If I have an audience of 1,000 people, I can, over an hour, get to their souls and open them up to understand what their moral responsibility is and should be. But it takes a bit of work, but I'm used to that as being a physician, having to, you know, handle patients over many years.
Well, Dr. Helen Caldicott, we are about out of time in this segment. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, perhaps a website or a place where people can find out more about what you're doing?
Yes. If you go to my website, helencaldicottfoundation.org, you can download that symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine on Fukushima and listen to it. And there are numerous articles on that website, also some by me, explaining the whole thing in detail. Number one, my private website, helencaldicott.com, has all my books. I don't make money for my books, but I suggest that you read them all, because once you get the information, you will be impelled to act. And be prepared to go through the stages of grief. Once you take in and imbibe these facts, one is shock and disbelief. This can't be true. The next is profound depression. Allow yourself to feel that. And as you evolve through that into anger, suddenly you're going to know what you must do, what you particularly must do with your special abilities. And no one will tell you. You'll just know. And use your anger in a white-hot focus to decide that you are going to change the earth. One person can change things, and indeed I helped lead the movement for the nuclear freeze in the 80s. I was an alien, I was a woman, I was a young doctor, but I had the passion in my soul to save life on Earth, and that's what we all must develop, because in truth the Earth is in the intensive care unit, critically ill, and we are now all physicians to a planet that's maybe dying, but maybe we can save it. And we must have the same dedication that we as physicians have at 3 a.m. in the morning when we've got a patient in the intensive care who's in multiple organ failure. We don't think of ourselves. We only think of our patient. And that's what we must do if we love this planet, if we love our children, if we love our grandchildren, and if we love the roses and the wisteria and nature.
Dr. Helen Caldicott, thank you so much for your sage advice, your wisdom, and all your activism over the years surrounding nuclear power, nuclear weaponry, and for being a doctor and trying to get the rest of us around the world to care about our patient, the Earth. Thank you for joining us.
That's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
The second half of the show, we'll talk with Jim Riccio, a lawyer who has worked for Greenpeace since 2001 as its nuclear policy analyst. Please stay with us.
I study nuclear science. I love my classes. I got a crazy teacher. He wears dark glasses. Things are going great, and they're only getting better. I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright. I gotta wear shades. I gotta wear
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our discussion on Fukushima with Jim Riccio, a lawyer who has worked with Greenpeace since 2001 as a nuclear policy analyst. Jim has over two decades of nuclear activist experience with success stories such as the shutdown of the Trojan Nuclear Power Plant in Rainier, Oregon, also the Rancho Seco Nuclear Power Plant near Sacramento, California. In addition, as a lawyer, Jim has worked to prevent the deregulation of nuclear waste to keep it from being recycled into consumer products and sued the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to protect the public's rights in the licensing of new reactors. Jim Riccio, join us today by phone.
My pleasure, guys.
So tell us what's going on right now. What kind of work are you doing right now on Fukushima?
The work Greenpeace is doing right now, like just this fall, we were over there doing testing to, again, ensure that the supposed cleanup was actually being effective. And we basically found that it wasn't. You could find that high levels of contamination just feed away from where they had supposedly cleaned up the site. The things that concern to us right now is the fact that while the leaking tanks are getting a lot of attention, and those are problematic and they're dangerous for the workers on the site, you have between 300 and 400 tons of water that are flowing off that mountain, flowing into the radioactive rubble, and then flowing into the ocean on a daily basis. And this is why we're seeing the attempt to put the ice wall around the nuclear plant, is again to stop that flow into the ocean, because the accident hasn't stopped. The meltdowns have stopped, but there's a continuous flow of radiation into the ocean.
Jim, hi, this is Peter Phillips. What's the possibilities, long-term possibilities, of just discontinuing nuclear reactors in the world? I mean, if there's a mass mobilization, Helen Caldicott was calling for that. But I remember Rancho Seco. I lived over in Sacramento at the time. And it took years and years. So how hard is it to do this, and is it feasible?
It's certainly feasible. The reality is that you can phase out nuclear power plants in this country and globally and replace them with clean, renewable energy. And some of the technology breakthroughs you're seeing coming in both wind, solar, and battery storage are making that feasible. There's a reason that the former head of the FERC said that, you know, we won't need any coal plants or nuke plants in the future. And he's right. You have a few plants that are under construction here in this country, but that's only because the government's paying for them. In reality, you have solar and wind are basically changing the electricity marketplace as we know it and pose an existential threat to those nuclear and electric corporations that would sell us nuclear electricity.
Well, Jim Riccio, we've known for some time and, of course, bring this point up often when we cover nuclear stories. It's a fairy tale, essentially, that there's such a thing as clean or safe nuclear energy without subsidization. No private companies want to insure it. It's really strange that in an allegedly free market society where the market gets to decide things, that's been the opposite of what we've seen in the nuclear industry. And they have very powerful lobbies, and that's basically how they got themselves into Japan. So we've covered the history of that as well. Can you tell us what you know is going on since you were there with Greenpeace not long ago? What is the reality of the cleanup effort there? What can we realistically be expecting?
I don't think you can be expecting very much. I mean, you know, even the places that have been cleaned up, again, you haven't done it thoroughly, and you still are exposing people to levels of radiation that will present a risk. I'm sure Dr. Caldicott got into this, but you know, there is no point below which radiation doesn't cause damage. A little bit of radiation means a little bit of risk. A lot of radiation means a lot of risk. So when we're seeing them clean up, say, a schoolyard and then place the radioactive bundles next to the school so the kids have to walk by it to get to class, that doesn't give you a feeling that they're really taking this, well, not that they're not taking it seriously, but that they perhaps don't grasp the seriousness of the situation. I don't think they want to dose their own people, but the fact is you're just not able to clean up these sites to the point where they won't pose a risk. And what we specialized in was checking, going into those areas that had been claimed were already clean. And my colleagues found that, in fact, the monitoring station was cleaner, but it wasn't clean. And then once you moved from that, the surrounding areas were highly contaminated still. You have a big dead zone where people aren't supposed to move back, just the same way we've had it around Chernobyl, to a lesser scale because a lot of the radiation, again, was blowing into the ocean and flowing into the ocean. But it's a problem for the Japanese, and the risks are going to be going on for a very long time. We don't really know where the cores of the reactors are at this point. We know they're somewhere below what used to be the reactors. But it's going to be years before we can get into, you know, even attempt to clean up the mess there, let alone the fallout.
This is a disaster of epic proportion that you're describing.
It is epic. As far as I'm concerned, this actually, you know, to my mind, is a little bit worse than Chernobyl, even though Chernobyl, you know, blew it up into the stratosphere and it traveled the planet, because this is ongoing.
And I think the danger of the ongoing nature of this catastrophe is that it seems to just blend in with background noise. I mean, one of the things, of course, that we mentioned with Dr. Helen Caldicott was raising awareness and, you know, trying to get access to information. So on the flip side of this, on one hand, we have Japanese government and TEPCO silencing whistleblowers, trying to punish people who are talking about it, censor news reports and so on coming out. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have people in the blogosphere writing outlandish stories that are completely unsubstantiated. So it's kind of a wilderness of its own trying to find out what's going on.
And you know, you're dead right. And sadly, you know, the problem is a lot of the reality gets lost in the mix. You're not sure what to believe. The public isn't sure what to believe. And the sources that I've been going back to, I have not bothered with the International Atomic Energy Agency. They're propagandists. Again, this is why we sent our own people in, why my colleagues and activists took a dose to go and ensure that we were getting accurate readings and could accurately assess what was going on the ground there. And I remember it vividly. The concern, too, is with, you have Abe, Prime Minister Abe, claiming that the situation was under control, and there just isn't any basis in truth to that. It is so far out of control, and so now you can't really believe what the Japanese government are saying about the situation. TEPCO and this whole attempt to wrap the accident in a secrecy law doesn't engender any confidence in the government either. You know, rather than clamping down on information, the Japanese government needs to be more transparent. And sadly, from my experience, that just does not come naturally.
And we need to be clear, too, just quickly, a couple of the biggest phony kind of stories that have circulated the internet, that 98% of the sea life at the bottom of the ocean was dead, and another one about the giant squid washing up. I mean, again, it's these kinds of inflated and hyperbolic tales aren't helping matters.
No, it doesn't help because it's a distraction from the real concerns and the daily problems that the Japanese are experiencing. Don't get me wrong. There's a risk from Fukushima, and it's in Japan. You look at the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear power, and you can understand people's concerns. We all grew up watching adventure movies and superhero movies where everything was caused by radiation. So I understand people being confused at times. And again, when you have such bad information coming from government sources, it's a problem. Now, there was a point I did see the NRC chairman, and this is a chairman I actually respect. The last two chairmen, both the ones that have been appointed by Obama, have not been basically beholden to the nuclear industry. And the previous chairman, Greg Yasko, upon leaving the commission, basically took up the Greenpeace position that nuclear power needs to be phased out. Again, because we can't prevent the land contamination like we've seen in Japan. Now, the current chairman, And I actually put a call into their office not too long ago to just to check on the source of their data. They said what's reaching the West Coast between 2014 and 2016 will be below 100 times below EPA drinking water limits. So again, the threat from Fukushima is in Japan. By the time it gets into the Pacific, it's a large body of water. And again, you're not going to be drinking salt water anyway.
Jim Riccio, one of the issues that Helen brought up is the long-term genetic impacts of radioactivity. You know, and so starting with Hiroshima, Nagasaki testings, the Chernobyl, of course, and now Fukushima, there's a increasing amount of human exposure to radioactivity around the world. It's
Helen,
kind of a Russian roulette kind of thing with our genetic future.
When you add on top of that the exposure we have to toxics and the synergistic effects from that, there's reason that epidemiology isn't an exact science. It's very difficult to prove that a specific radionuclide causes a specific cancer. But we do know certain things. Like after Chernobyl, we saw a lot of thyroid cancer, and we're seeing that again after Fukushima in the population that was exposed around the plant. And again, we're seeing it in young people because, again, the radiation affects them more. To say that we don't have an issue and to say that it's under control when it's not, you know, I understand the Japanese wanting to secure the Olympic Games for Tokyo, but they've undermined people's confidence in the veracity of their statements because you can't believe what Abe was saying.
Jim Riccio, what is going on? We started the conversation by asking what's happening with Greenpeace. Is there a plan to go back and do more readings or readings ongoing? What's Greenpeace doing? What direction is Greenpeace heading on what's going on with Fukushima and with nuclear power and weaponry broadly?
In general, what we're trying to do specifically in Japan is we're trying to keep the reactors down, the reactors offline, and enhance the cleanup. Internationally, we're working to basically oppose the expansion of new nuclear power. We were very successful here in the States at beating back several proposed nuclear power plants by Duke Energy, and we've been doing the same work abroad. Right now, the growth in this industry is coming from the Asian market, and that's where a lot of our international efforts are focused at this point. Again, trying to prevent the expansion of nuclear power into Korea, really assuring that we can keep as many nuclear power plants offline in Japan as possible. We don't want to see any of them come back. The Germans now are showing us how you can do this, how you can basically get off of nuclear very quickly, and other countries should follow suit because, again, we just got lucky in California. You just had a self-inflicted wound take San Onofre off of the plate. But you still have Diablo Canyon there. And we should be focusing on phasing out these reactors, securing their waste, so they don't pose an inimical threat to our public health and safety.
Jim Riccio, we're coming up on the third anniversary here in March of the Fukushima catastrophe. Great activist here in the Bay Area that's helped us put together our interviews with Dr. Caldicott and yourself, Robert Manning. We were talking about what actions are on the plate for the third anniversary. Is there a Greenpeace effort to raise global awareness about this? Is there something in the works? And if not, what could be in the works raising awareness here? Calling the consulates, have a mass day of global protest?
As you guys know, and I don't know how much you follow what was going on with our ship and the Russians, but we don't really announce our actions prior to when they come down. We have been doing a lot of work both petitioning the Japanese government and getting petitions to different governments to basically phase out nuclear. And again, you know, specific work in different countries on specific reactors. At this point, as we learned from Rancho Seco, it's a difficult task to take down a nuclear power plant. We just won a victory in Vermont not too long ago where we had a 26-4 vote in the Vermont legislature to shut down the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. And it still took us a couple of years to basically finish them off.
And about how long does it take then to take the plant offline, and how long does it take to decommission? We brought this up with Helen Caldicott. One of the figures she threw out was 30 years.
It can take a very long time. And you guys remember, we shut down Rancho Seco back in 1989. That plant is still not thoroughly decommissioned. in some ways, it's a good thing. So what they do is they seal up the reactor and they allow the radiation to dissipate so the workers take less of a dose. So that's good for the workers, but there's also this great concern that these corporations, you know, because they're no longer nuclear, they're no longer utilities. These are for-profit corporations, and the concern is that they will disappear and go away, and the public will be left holding the bag for a lot of the costs of cleanup. You're a little bit concerned if you have to wait 30 years to see San Onofre finally thoroughly dismantled.
Yeah, Jim Riccio, we may not have 30 years looking at how many tons of radioactive water is keep flowing daily in from Fukushima. And we brought this up earlier in the program. I'd like to bring this up with you, too. Helen Caldicott kept saying we need to raise awareness, and given that, again, it's hard to find information, this has become sort of a background or backdrop issue for a lot of people, even though it's extremely dangerous and it continues to pose a problem, not just Fukushima, but nuclear energy and weaponry worldwide. So part of the raising of awareness, recently there was reporting about over 70 sailors in the U.S. Navy on the USS Ronald Reagan. They'd been contaminated, and they're showing very, very negative health impact from exposure to radiation there. It's sad that this might be the kind of thing that raises awareness.
It is, and it's sad, too, that their exposure was in an attempt to help the Japanese in the midst of their crisis. We're going to see and continue to see the fallout from Fukushima for a very long time. As we've noted, it is not nearly under control. I almost feel all the attention that was being given to the leaking tanks was almost a bait and switch. Like, oh, we have a leak, but the leak isn't just a little, small little drop. It's hundreds of tons a day. So the attempt by the Japanese to downplay the significance, I don't think they're working, to tell you the truth. And from what we've seen on both the West Coast as well as when I was over in Europe, there's a lot of concern about Fukushima globally still. Despite the fact that people's attention has been drawn elsewhere, there is still a great effort on the part of all of us within the movement as well as those outside of it to ensure that nuclear power is phased out and that we can have the clean and renewable energy that everyone wants and that doesn't pose a threat to our homes, our families, and our communities. And the best way the Californians can do that is to now, you know, shift their focus onto Diablo Canyon and get that reactor basically shut down as well. It would be really nice to see California nuclear free.
Jim Riccio, where can people go to find out more information about what you're doing and Greenpeace is doing around these issues and other issues?
Just go to greenpeace.org, and you can take action on our pages as well. And we encourage you not only to get in touch with us, but also to work within your local communities, because that's who we work with on a daily basis.
Jim Riccio, thanks so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us about these very important issues. Again, we're very appreciative for all of your efforts. Keep up the good work. Thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. The program originates out of KPFA Studios in Berkeley, California. For archives of our shows, visit projectcensored.org, and please keep tabs and like us on Facebook at Project Censored. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. We'll see you next time.